Welcome to Spotcast, Season 3, Episode 18, Stardate 98524, Mark 46. My name is Tim Trudeau. I'm in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined once again by Jonathan Kuline in Mississauga, Ontario.
Hello there.
We're also joined by Jaime Lopez Jr. in Mrs. Seattle, Ontario. No, that's not right. Mrs. Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
pretty good. So this week we're going to be covering Discovery Season 3, Episode 8, The Sanctuary. But in the meantime, we have some fact-checky kind of things to do, so let's get with the homework. We were talking last week, I was talking about the black comm badges, which in fact were, Jonathan was correct, they are Section 31. Mm. And I've got a link here in the show notes. When Discovery, we first started the podcast, I bought some badges from this company called QMX Online. I don't know that they're necessarily keeping up to date. They've got a whole bunch of different things you can buy, but because they don't have the new comm badges, which I thought would be something they would start working on, but you can still buy the black badges. You can also buy other badges like Voyager badges and Star Trek badges and, you know, Next Generation badges as well. So that's kind of cool. But like I said, I don't know if they're keeping up with production. It's been a few years since I chatted with them. And I just want to point out, just, you know, on Season 3, Episode 16 of our show, two episodes ago, that I did correctly say, I guess it would be Tilly would become number one, even though it was kind of we all thought it was a long shot, right?
All right. And bonus points for you.
Bonus points for me. I know that and a bus ticket would get me downtown. Oh, wait a minute. I'm already downtown. And the last thing was unification, which is what we talked about before, which is the famous, you know, Leonard Nimoy, Patrick Stewart crossover universe thing. That premiered November 4th, 1991. And it was, I think next week was, or it was two-parter. Second week was the week after that on the 11th, I think, right?
Yep.
If I do my math correctly.
I was in high school and Jaime was in diapers.
I was, let's see, fourth grade.
He's driving his big wheel around.
10 years old at that point.
Nice.
Right, driving his big wheel.
And Tim was old enough to buy cigarettes, alcohol, and pornography.
Yeah, I would have been a mere 31 years old.
A mere 31.
Yeah, a mere 31. All right, so that was a long time ago. so let's head into the headlines, and Jonathan's going to take over on the headlines.
Yeah, we've had a really interesting week. The big news was from today. We got the news. Warner Brothers is going to release every single one of its 2021 movies on HBO Max the same time it's releasing them into movie theaters. And that is seismic. That is huge news. We're not talking about like run-of-the-mill stuff here. We knew they were doing this with Wonder Woman 1984, but here's some of the lineup that we're talking about for next year. We're talking about The Matrix 4, Suicide Squad 2, we're talking about Dune, we're talking about Godzilla vs. Kong. We're talking about, you know, a whole huge lineup of 17 movies, including some really A-list stuff.
I believe it's a cavalcade of movies.
Yeah, and Space, the new Space Jam, the new LeBron James Space Jam, the new prequel that's coming out for Sopranos. This is a huge lineup of stuff, and they're going to roll this out over the course of the year on HBO Max. I mean, man, HBO Max just became a must service. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Jaime, was this it?
Jaime has no excuses now.
Was this it? Was this the tipping point?
Yeah. You know, let me do some follow-up on that's related to, I took your guys' advice. So like, we had the free HBO Max on YouTube TV for the holiday weekend, and we watched all of Watchmen, the one season, and The Undoing, and we watched a few episodes of Succession, which got us interested. So we're like, okay, well, when we get HBO Max again, let's watch that one. And I had said on the previous show, or maybe a couple episodes ago, that definitely interested in doing Wonder Woman 1984. I know it's not for free, because you would be paying like $19 a month for HBO Max, I think is the price, or $14.95, whatever.
Really?
It is.
Wow, it's steep.
Yeah, it's like a Netflix at that point. And so I'm like, well, I mean, there's other things to watch, right? We have other HBO shows to watch, and it's almost like getting the movie for free. So if you then have the entire Warner Brothers theatrical release schedule for 2021 in there, I'm like, oh, I guess I'll be paying for that for a whole bunch of months.
Don't forget Tom and Jerry, right?
And that was one of the ones that I on Twitter had like explicitly excluded from that show, but perhaps not banned from all shows. yeah, it's very compelling, and it's probably good timing, because I don't think there's anything else for CBS All Access after Discovery Season 3 ends. So it'd actually be a pretty good time to end the $6.99 or $5.99 a month and use some of that to pay towards the HBO Max, which I didn't check the release schedule and see, is it literally every month that they will have something and they'll just sort of keep me along as CBS All Access did with Lower Decks and Discovery and Picard. But you know what? That's not a bad place to be in, right? I've said on this show that your job as a streaming service is to keep me with just enough content that I'm like, yeah, I'm going to go ahead and subscribe.
The first question is, is this enough to get you to subscribe? Yes. The second question is, how much of a game change is this in both of your minds? Like, they're saying this is an extraordinary time. This is only a one-time thing, but people are getting used to what they're getting used to. You hear people all the time saying, well, I don't want to go to work 5 days a week now. I'm used to this. What are they going to do to get people back into movie theaters after this kind of convenience?
Yeah, good question.
Yeah, I think it'll be an event for theaters. You know, you go see Raiders of the Lost Ark again because it's an event. Maybe you see this one movie that I could watch it on HBO Max, but it'd be way better to see it in theaters because it's got all the pew pew pews, right?
Well, I guess that's a question though. Like, since streaming has become so popular over the last few years, notwithstanding the pandemic, I mean, are people really going to the theaters? I mean, the three of us are, of course, right? Because we're movie files and we're, you know, we like our big bug of popcorn and stuff like that and paying, you know, $12 for it. But, you know, I go to see movies by myself. Like, I mean, sometimes I saw Gravity by myself because, you know, some people don't like Sandra Bullock that much.
It's not Sandra Bullock. You know,
and then,
It's not Sandra Bullock.
What isn't Gravity?
No, wasn't the reason I didn't go.
Oh, it's the other guy. Yeah. The other guy. Yeah. He's only in half of the movie.
Well, and to be fair, honestly, more than anything, it was the plot. But anyways, continue.
Yeah. I mean, it was like, it blew up real good. That's basically it. Like, it was completely implausible, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you read anything or even listen to Chris Hadfield talk, there's no effing way they did any of that stuff.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the space station would have just gone flying off into space, right?
Yeah, and any micro shard of stuff up there would have killed them.
Yes, exactly. Well, they do have things happen, but yeah, it would be pretty catastrophic at the base of that movie. Anyway, notwithstanding, you know, Tom Cruise movies, you know, I went and saw Unforgiven by myself years ago. Mm. You know, just, I like seeing things in the theater. I like the big screen, big sound, you know. For a while there, I think about 5 or 6 years, I went to see a movie every Friday, no matter what, right? You know, and that's how I saw such sleeper things like Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels and Shaun of the Dead and things like that before anybody else did, right? And, you know, but even still, I went to the film festival last year and saw Parasite before anybody else and went, you guys got to see this. And you're like, you know, no, I don't think so. But anyway, I think for the masses, you know, if you can get a 50-inch TV at home and set up your home theater with your surround sound, you know, a lot of people's attitude is, I don't need to go to the theater to see stuff, right? So I think this is the pandemic has sort of forced the hands of people like Disney and HBO to sort of, you know, step it up a bit, you know, because they're not going to get the revenues that they would normally get at theaters. But I don't know, I kind of get the impression, or it's been my sense, that movie going has been on the decline, you know, over the last several years, right?
Yeah, well, especially on the on-demand culture, it's just another thing, you know. People don't want the inconvenience of having to go out. Even, you're right, notwithstanding the pandemic, people were, do I have to go and do the thing? There's always going to be, you know, especially for our generations, there's going to be people who like that experience, the same people who like to go to concerts. They like to be among people to have that shared experience, as well as the big sound, big screen, the whole nine. But there's a lot of people who are like, you know what, I want it at my fingertips. I want it when I want it. I want it when, you know, I can not leave the house to do it. And, you know, whether that has anything to do with the pandemic or not.
Well, the other side of it too is I think about this every now and then when I watch a series. Like I was telling Jonathan while you were away there, Jaime, that I did watch The Watchmen as well, right? You know, like when you go to see a movie in the theater and you've got depending on the director, you have 2 hours to watch a story like a Dunkirk or something like that, or you know, 3 hours if it's, you know, some of these crazy other directors and stuff. You know, they have to sort of compact all that, like, you know, the Harry Potter books, have to compact them down into a movie. And you know, there's a whole lot of subplots in the movies from the books that have been dropped from the movies because of time constraints, right? But then you turn around and you watch something like like Watchmen on TV, which is like 8 episodes, or Mandalorian, you know, where they can stretch it out and have very few dead spots in it. You can have long running arcs and stuff like that. And you know, it's not necessarily meant that you binge it, you know, for 10 hours or whatever it takes to watch these things, but it's a different kind of storytelling when it's like that. And you know, I don't think you could do a Game of Thrones in the theater, right? Because not to say you couldn't make a Game of Thrones movie, because obviously Downton Abbey proved you can, but, or so did Sex and the City, but you can really, it's a different experience when you get to watch something serialized like that over a long period of time, even if you only get to watch it every couple of weeks, right? Or every week, once a week kind of thing, right? So I think that's a different thing. I mean, it's created a whole different media for watching, for consuming stories, right? Is the fact that you can't afford to go see these in the theater kind of thing, right?
Yeah. I don't know. This is, and it'll be interesting to see. We've seen, you know, I think we've done a good job so far in our most recent season of this podcast in sort of highlighting the progression of these dominoes being knocked over. This is by far the biggest one so far. You know, obviously we've had the Mulan experiment, Tenet, we've done some different things. I really am curious to see what the competitors do following this move too. You know, this is Warner Brothers basically saying 2021 is a write-off. That is their projection for movie.
I don't know if you've heard, but it is a write-off.
Well, again, there is reason for optimism based on the fact that there are promising vaccines, but then it'll take time to get them out and everything else. You know, I've read a lot as I'm a pop culture fan, but also I'm a sports fan, and I just love to read and learn. So I've been reading a lot about what kind of planning the sports leagues are doing around the potential, because they're losing buckets full of money, not having fans in the seats, buying concessions, all that stuff. So I've been keeping track of that, and their leagues are all prepping for the fact that it would be like the last few months of 2021 would be the earliest we could start seeing people back in those in abundance. There might be smatterings of fans, but we're really not going to see the volume of those until later in the year. So Warner Brothers is throwing up its hands and saying, okay, so this is the way that we make HBO Max a must service, so people will give us their money for that. We get a lot of attention for this move, and you know, we have to kind of eat some crap on the fact that, you know, we're not going to make nearly what we thought we would make in the theater on this next year, but we also buy some goodwill. And you know, maybe if, you know, Matrix 4 or Suicide Squad 2 or one of these movies is a huge hit on the service, then that drives more people back to the theater for the next one, right? But at the same time, it, you know, it really could be the first of a wave. Now, you know, what does Disney do? They've got their two services. They've got Disney Plus and they've got Hulu. What do they do with Black Widow? What do they do with the Eternals? What do they do with Shang-Chi? You know, what are we going to see from, you know, James Bond was supposed to come out next year. It's supposed to be out this year, but it's, you know, moved to next year. What's going to happen with that one? What is going to happen with these other big properties? Because just going to theaters is just not a solution. And again, that's what we talked about on last episode, was the idea that that is the only option available for Wonder Woman for Canada is kind of galling. And now all of these properties are destined for HBO Max in the United States.
What about Canada?
Well,
right?
It does. And unfortunately, this story broke late this afternoon. So as of this recording, we don't have any kind of information on that. I'm hoping that you know, some intrepid Canadian media reporter will dig into it over the next couple of days, and we'll be able to talk about it next week. But if it's anything like what we've had established is going to be the pattern for Wonder Woman, like, that's not good news for Canadian film fans at all.
Right.
All right. Well, let's move off of that. And we've got a couple of side bits this week. So David Prowse, the famous actor who played Darth Vader in the Star Wars original trilogy, unfortunately passed away this week. He was a huge human being, apparently 6'6", and was, you know, this sort of towering figure, and he had this very imposing physique, and that was exactly what George Lucas was looking for, and cast this gentle giant as his Darth Vader. But he had apparently you know, not the right voice, so James Earl Jones provided the voice, since obviously he didn't have to move his mouth or lips or anything like that. But yeah, again, this is, unfortunately, this is starting to become a little bit sad. We're seeing a whole generation of actors from Star Wars sort of slipping away from us, obviously.
Yeah, we're running out of Star Wars. I mean, it's basically
Harrison Ford, Mark Hamill, and Tony Daniels is C-3PO. That's pretty much what's
the
left.
Main characters. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I guess you could say Frank Oz. I mean, you know, he's still with us, thank goodness. But yeah, it's starting to get and Billy Dee Williams. All right, well, we'll throw him in there. But yeah, it's sad. It's sad that we're losing this generation again. Good life, you know, David Prowse. Obviously, he leveraged that, and he was very popular out on the you know conventions and signing autographs and stuff like that. And he made it to 85, so a good long life. But sad, really sad.
Yeah, he. I mean, of course, he was in Clockwork Orange as the trainer.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I mentioned this before that they filmed Jabberwocky and Jabberwocky and Star Wars, on the same time at the same lot. So a lot of actors moved back and forth, and of course he played the Black Knight in Jabberwocky as well. So
mm-hmm.
And it was the Michael Palin was his, what do you call the guy who carries the swords, his second or whatever?
Oh, his
serf?
Yeah, vassal. I don't know. Yep. So another loss, but rest in peace, Mr. Prowse. Thanks for everything.
Yeah. I also was reading he also auditioned for Chewbacca.
Yeah, and again, it would have made sense that too. I mean, it's funny to think that he was smaller in stature than Peter Mayhew. Yeah. It's crazy. Yeah. And following this theme, and unfortunately, another loss this week. Hugh Case Byrne, who mm-hmm. was the star, the villain in two Mad Max movies, passed away this week. He was 73. He was Toe Cutter, the bad guy from the original Mad Max in 1979, and then he came back in 2015 and played Immortan Joe, the main bad guy in Fury Road. And so obviously, you know, very popular with the director that, you know, he got recast, you know, 36 years later. But yeah, he was, again, a working actor for a long time. He was, you know, he was on Farscape. He was on all kinds of other things over the years. But to be the villain in two sort of iconic sci-fi movies like that is it's a pretty good legacy.
Sad day.
Mm-hmm. The other bit of big news we got this week was that Canadian actor, formerly known as Ellen Page, has come out as transgender and will now prefer to be called Elliot Page and prefer to be called he. So Elliot Page released this information over social media and got a lot of support for his decision. This is a pretty milestone event as well. This is the first, I mean, this is an Oscar-nominated actor who has come out as transgender, and that's a huge step forward for people who feel, disenfranchised and feel, persecuted, which is, you know, it's an unfortunate and tragic thing that is happening in that community. But one of the immediate questions I think that a lot of people had was, you know, as Vanya, the star of the Umbrella Academy, how does that affect the show going forward as well? Because, you know, Elliot is the star of the show, more or less.
Right,
and so, sure enough, the day after this information came out, VanityFair.com has a story saying that Netflix was immediately supportive and that Elliot will continue to be the star of Umbrella Academy Season 3. I'm not sure how that's going to work, if Elliot will be comfortable playing roles as male and female, or how that will play out, or if it will change the way that the season needs to be written to accommodate Elliot's decision. But pretty pretty interesting news, and then pretty interesting news that they're going to make this work on Umbrella Academy.
Right, right. Well, they may have already started filming, right?
Yeah, I can't say. I mean, I know they do that here in Toronto, but I don't know whether or not it's back in production or where they're at with that right now.
Right, right.
The second season of Umbrella Academy saw Vanya's character start exploring a same-sex relationship as a female. So a female-female relationship. But it'll be interesting to see if this development of Elliot's life will impact the way that they write Vanya's character. What did you guys think of this? I mean, it's a pretty, again, it's not a small thing. This is a well-known and well-regarded actor.
Well, I will say it was a surprise. I don't begrudge him that decision, but it's just odd. You know, star of Juno, star of a number of things.
Inception.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's another big one. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's odd. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you know, males have been playing female roles since the Greek theater, right? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. not unusual for people to play different genders, you know, but if they can pull it off, as it were, right? You know?
Yeah.
It's a decision that the actor will make when, you know, and their manager will make when they take roles, right?
Yeah, it will be interesting to see the kind of choices that Elliot makes going
Tom
forward.
Tom Cruise is probably shaking in his boots now, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it will be. It really will be interesting to see what kind of roles that that he chooses, and then also what's available too. You know, as obviously as open minded as a lot of people are, some people aren't. So I wonder if people will be comfortable if there will be any kind of career setbacks because of this decision. I mean, that would be horrible, but you know, there are people in power who obviously make poor decisions.
Well, some of them are in jail now. Thanks.
Yeah.
For that.
Yeah. You know? No, that's great.
Because that would have been, I'm sure that kind of culture would have been a challenge.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Next up, we'll try and pound through a few fast ones. Doctor Who, we talked about that there was going to be a festive special for the Doctor Who next episode, but we didn't know when. We now know it is coming on New Year's Day. So set your PVRs, kids. We're going to get our next episode, and it is going to be centered around the Daleks. So it should be really interesting to see what comes of that. Apparently, they're going to be getting a remake. We're going to see the return of John Barrowman. It's going to be interesting. Apparently, this is the episode where we're going to see, you know, the final fate of a few of the trio of companions. So, yeah, be definitely worth tuning in on New Year's Day.
Yeah, the Whovians among the crowd, myself included, would have known that it was going to be about the Daleks for a number of weeks now, right? So, because they've been hinting at that and talking about it and previewing it. So I think we covered this before, but the three companions are going away after this season or after the show?
Two of them are leaving.
Okay.
Yeah. So we'll see how it plays forward. There was a rumor going around, so take it with a grain of salt. There was a rumor going around that the next season could focus on a relationship between the Doctor and... The Doctor, played by Jodie Whittaker, and Mandeep Gill's character. What's her character's name? Yasmin.
Oh. Ooh.
Again, no confirmation. Nobody's talking about it, but that's been going around in the sci-fi blogosphere.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Brains will explode, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Some unfortunate news on this one. The Utopia, the series that we had talked about in previous episodes, that is a Amazon Prime series. Amazon Prime has canceled it. They are not going to pursue a second season. So we had spoken about the fact that it really didn't have a satisfying season one ending. It really just sort of built towards a come back next time for more. So, you know, and it was kind of an up and down series. It was interesting concept, but a little uneven. So I guess the numbers just don't bear it out. So it had a great
beginning. You know, the first four
concept's great. Really the concept good. Is exceptional. The execution was a little all over the place.
Yeah, it kind of fizzled out in the last episode. So
yeah,
I think you and I both talked about that.
Yeah. So c'est la vie. Unfortunately, sci-fi is a tough sell sometimes, but it's gone. The good folks at Troma are rebooting Toxic Avenger. And beyond that,
like we don't have a dumpster fire already.
What? Beyond that, Toxie is going to be played by Peter Dinklage of Game of Thrones, Tyrion Lannister himself. I'm not a huge B movie horror fan, but I have seen the Toxic Avenger. It is, you know, completely nonsensical. The Troma guys come to Fan Expo here in Toronto every year, or not every year, but have come many times, and they're always lots of fun. They're really into it. It'll be interesting. Apparently, it's going to be, they say it's going to be a la Deadpool, very sort of aware, breaking the fourth wall, sort of satire of itself kind of piece. And Dinklage is an amazing actor, so maybe it'll be better than it sounds, but it sounds kind of weird.
Right.
Toxic Avenger.
I'm trying to remember if I've actually seen, I've definitely seen the bits and pieces. I think I'm more familiar with the made for kids cartoon Toxic Crusaders, which had more than just the Toxic Avenger. It had a whole bunch of people who had been disfigured in some way by toxic ooze, toxic waste. So, maybe I should see if the streaming service somewhere has Toxic Avenger so I can catch up and compare.
Coming 2021 to HBO Max, Toxic Avenger.
But isn't the whole toxic, you know, isn't that sort of a 70s and 80s sort of thing, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The idea was that he was supposed to to be a nerd. He, you know, some bullies basically throw him into a vat full of toxic waste, and he emerges as this disfigured but now Herculean character who, you know, gets his revenge with, you know, a mop in hand. It's right. It's pretty cheeseball.
Cleans up town.
Yeah, it's pretty cheeseball, the original. They've done sequels over the years and different iterations, including the one Jaime mentioned, but it'll be interesting to see if they, you know, if they're trying to take this more seriously, or not more seriously, but also just putting some heft behind it. Again, Dinklage is great. I mean, I'd watch him do almost anything, so that buys me some goodwill there, but I don't know.
Yeah, okay. Even Elf?
Oh, he's funny in Elf. Come on. he plays the straight guy, but he's so funny.
Yeah. All right. This next story, I don't know. I can't take it.
It's a never-ending thing, Tim, as long as there are animated movies within Disney's grasp. It has learned that the people, they're hungry for live action remakes. And in this case, apparently Peter Pan and Pinocchio, I was not aware those were even being remade, may skip theaters in favor of streaming. Again, very similar on theme to things we've heard about things just saying, all right, let's put it on streaming and we'll figure out how to make our money there.
So the reason why I'd say that I have trouble with this one is, have you ever heard of an actress named Mary Martin?
Not ringing a bell.
No, you haven't.
Played Peter Pan on stage. Peter Pan
on stage before the animated show became, before the Disney made a movie out of Peter Pan. Peter Pan was a stage play originally with, you know, people flying on wires, right? So yeah, it's kind of odd. In fact, you know, the reason why I say I know this is because as a kid, we had the Peter Pan soundtrack album at home and we used to listen to it. And I was always surprised, but why is Mary Martin playing the role of Peter Pan? I couldn't get my head wrapped around that, right? And it turned out we had the soundtrack from the stage play, not from the cartoon, the Disney cartoon. So yeah. And actually, they did. Well, The Hook is sort of a live action remake too, right? Of Peter Pan with Robin Williams. And
there's been a few over the years, different takes on that. But this one, I think, is going to sort of be truer to the Peter Pan of Disney ilk, which people are so
fond of. Well, I think these stories were actually pre-Disney. Like Pinocchio is an Italian fairy tale, right?
Oh, of course. Yeah, of course. They've adapted these sort of timeless classics over the years. Cinderella, obviously, all those different ones. And some of them are originals, of course.
Yep.
But yeah, it's so these are going to possibly go to Disney Plus 2?
Okay. Seems like it.
Or Disney Plus 18.
18 plus. Yes, yeah.
Well, now those ones I would watch. I would watch the 18 plus versions. Right. Cool. It's not just his nose that grows?
Right. Or it is his nose that grows. Only his nose.
My goodness. Another quick one from me. The CW is, of course, now the home of so much DC Comics property. We know that we're getting some new series. We're getting, obviously, the new Lois and Clark or Superman and Lois Lane series. But we're losing one, too. We knew that Supergirl was going off the air after this next season. And now we know Black Lightning is going off the air after season 4.
Where is Black Lightning seen?
CW. Yeah.
Oh, really? Okay.
And you can watch it here in Canada. It's available on Netflix. Okay, so it's, I think it's 2 days after it airs in the United States on CW. It airs in Canada on Netflix. Okay. I watched some of the first season, but didn't keep up with it. It had always sort of intended to sort of binge my way through the rest. It's unclear from this story if it's a sort of outright cancellation or just sort of a you know, it's time for the series to end. Although, given the length of time that some of the other series have run, only 4 seasons seems like it's more in that sort of not doing as well cancellation kind of realm. But did you get into Black Lightning?
I didn't really get into it. I watched probably half of the first season, and then it just wasn't clicking with me, and for reasons that escaped me, I didn't have it stick to my my rotation. So now that it's ending, maybe it's something I can watch the entire series. 4 seasons is kind of manageable. I don't think I could get into Flash or Arrow because it's just too many seasons for me to watch, given how many other things there are. Whereas, you know, four seasons, you know, you sneak one in, you know, a couple times a week. week when you're watching, you know, eating lunch or something, that's manageable. You'll finish before the end of time.
Well, and especially because it is a pseudo drama. So, I mean, we're talking 44, 45 minutes an episode too. It's not like it's a sitcom where you can plow through
right,
them.
Right.
Is it one of the Defenders?
No, that was the Netflix Marvel stuff. This is a DC property. No, but he was in the big
crossover thing,
Crisis on Infinite Earths, Arrowverse thing that they did. They brought him on board and brought him into the sort of pseudo Justice League thing that they started through that. So he was a part of that crossover, and it seemed like they were sort of setting the table for him to be a more of an active member of the superhero community, but maybe not.
Right. Okay, and we covered off a couple of weeks ago that in PlayStation 4 and 5, you could get the Apple TV app. And so it turns out that the Xbox is not to be left alone. The Xbox Wire, is that the new, what's the new system called? Not that it matters.
Series X.
Yes, okay. So it's on launch, which is probably a launch by now, but based on how old this story is going to have the Apple TV app. So you'll probably watch your Mythic Quest and your Ted Lasso and your For All Mankind, for what it's worth, as well as things like Disney Plus, Netflix, Hulu, Spotify. Those are all coming to, and HBO Max. Hey, look at that. They're also coming to the platform as well. So
yeah, it seems like they're centering the same way that PlayStation did. They're sort of centering themselves as this sort of one-stop, all-in-one box that sort of covers off all your home entertainment needs.
Yeah.
Although with a smart TV nowadays, do you need that? To
change it, right?
What's that?
Sorry? And all you need now is your controller to navigate the menu.
Yeah, pretty much. Do you, there's so many apps that are available straight through your TV now, though. I don't know, like, what do you guys use for your devices to have all your services? Like, I just have them all programmed into my television now. I don't even need a device.
So I use my Apple TV for a lot of, I stream a lot of things. Like if I'm watching something on my phone, I'll stream it to the TV. Mm. You know, if I'm watching a concert or something like that on my phone, from Facebook or whatever, or Vimeo, I'll scream it to the TV. The Apple TV, I mean. I do have Netflix and something else, Amazon Prime on my television itself, mm-hmm. right? So I'd use the Samsung app for that. But and it's funny because, like, you know, I don't know, it's this weird thing with Netflix. I can't seem to get the Netflix app on my Apple TV to work. I can't log into it, but I can log in on the TV. So I get a variety of things. Like I said before, if they count to set up on the Apple TV, it seems to show, you know, whatever is available, like Disney Plus and Amazon Prime and whatever come up on the Apple TV menu, because the apps are also logged in on the Apple TV itself, right? Mm. So I use a mix of things. You know, I watch cable TV a lot. I watch, you know, when I don't want to pay attention to TV, I'll put on cable. But if I want to focus or whatever, I'll watch on Prime or whatever. But
yeah. Jaime, how about you?
I use a Roku predominantly, and now that it has AirPlay 2 support, I think I can get around the silliness that comes up from time to time. Like, I think HBO Max is not available natively on the Roku because Roku and HBO are fighting over who gets the cuts of the monies. But with AirPlay, that shouldn't matter because I believe the app is available for iOS, so I'll just stream it from my phone or my iPad or something.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, good on them for trying anyways. I'm sure there's some people out there that's valuable to have all that in one spot, but I don't know. Feels like nowadays you don't need to have a hub device the way you did 5 years ago.
Definitely not.
Yeah, and I think that's why Quibi, amongst many things, like, you know, lack of good content, failed, in that you kind of need to launch on every platform nowadays so that people don't have to, oh man, I really wish I could watch this, but I can't because it's not available on my device. I'm like, well, it should be on your device. If what you've got is only a smart TV, cool, it should work on that. If what you've got is, oh, I've just got this PlayStation or Xbox, cool, it should work on that. It should work on like your dang toaster at this point, right? Your Samsung smart fridge should be able to stream this stuff, because why not?
Yeah, true.
Cool. All right.
Last thing this week, just a quick one, The Expanse.
That's still on TV?
It is, yes. The Expanse is coming back for its fifth season on December 16th on Amazon Prime. And they also announced that the sixth season has been greenlit. They're going to do a sixth season, and that will be final season.
So we're looking for five and six. Okay, cool.
Yeah, so five is going to air starting in a couple of weeks. And then after that, they're going to work on a six, and six will be the end. So for people who are looking for closure, people who might be listening listening to this podcast, it's going to get some closure, which is nice. It's always nice. It's far better to do that than what we're having, like we just talked about Utopia, right? Where you're sort of like, and then what happens?
Or Dark Matter.
Or Dark Matter, exactly right. Yep. And Dem's the headlines.
Well, this is the exciting part of the show, ladies and gentlemen, where we start talking and dissecting Discovery Season 3, Episode 8, The Sanctuary. And Jonathan is going to do... No, sorry, Jaime's doing...
No,
that was last time. That was the Thanksgiving Day recap.
You had
the Canadian. Series. In this case, we've got the American picking up the baton here. So, The Sanctuary, we roll into this one. Did you mention it was directed by Jonathan Frakes? It's here in the notes.
I was going to, but then I thought, why would I spoil it for you?
I wasn't going to mention it because I didn't know that fact, but it kind of makes sense. It kind of makes sense given some of the cinematography that happens. It's very Frakesian. So what have we got? So we've got Giorgio talking to Culber and very much not happy to be there, talking to our fair doctor. And she says, that, oh, by the way, that, you know, in her place, the emperor's personal physicians are buried with them when they die. Very similar to like Egyptian pharaohs having their pets buried with them. Presumably for the mirror universe,
and their doctors,
like, presumably this is to like have them have their secrets die with them, sort of thing. Yeah.
Well, and it's also to make sure that they do a good job of trying to keep their they won't take a bribe to, you know, let their patient die or something, right?
Yeah. That definitely totally makes sense.
Because it would be easy to slip the doctor, you know, a few thousand credits and say, you know, if when he dies, you can take over for me, or she dies, you can take over for me. It's a lot harder to do that when they say, hey, if that person dies, you're going with them.
Yeah. So it incentivizes loyalty for a very, you know, long chain of reasons. And Culber is like, you know, how long have these blackouts been happening? And apparently Giorgio will eventually start losing her sense of self. That's how disruptive this is to her. And Michael ends up being there when Culver does a scan, which finds an elevated heart rate, which is attributed to just her rage. But, you know, maybe not. Maybe she's got some issues there. And we end up with Michael and Book chatting in the hallway. He gives us sort of the reason for the main plot today, which is that he wants to go home because his brother has called for him. He talks about how when the burn hit their home planet, it resided in... I wrote title changes, but like I think it had affected subspace so much that their like moon or planet or something had shifted, and there were like all these vast environmental problems that occurred.
Yep.
And so Osira from the... I wrote it down. Is it the Emerald Chain?
The chain, yeah.
Yep, Emerald Chain.
Had come to tell him, like, hey, we have a fix to save your harvest from these sea locusts, right? But, oh, by the way, they wanted trance worms in return. So we get the setup here that the Emerald Chain, beyond having access to, you know, dilithium as a way to get their way about, they've essentially held various planets hostage for like, oh, we have the technology to help you, but you got to give us this thing in return, right? You got to pay this heavy price. So, you know, our fateful crew goes and talks to Admiral Vance about this. He's not convinced of the worthiness of this mission, doesn't want to send any of his ships, really doesn't want to allow Discovery to go with its spore drive. And there are political ramifications here, right? The Federation isn't well received, and anything that happens could be attributed as something that's like backlash for them, right? And Saru eventually convinces Vance, like, oh, well, Discovery can go there as observers. We're not going to cause any trouble, right? We're just there to help along. We cut over to back over to Hunhao, which is where Booker was held captive along with Rin, and nephew Tolor is complaining to his aunt Osira, and she's very much not happy that Tolor has lost Rin the Andorian. She sends Tolor into the trance worm cage to get mesmerized and munched.
Yeah, I said worm food.
That's definitely worm food. We get a little walk and talk with Saru and Tilly walking through the hallway discussing different things that are going on, including, you know, where are we with the ongoing matter? And apparently this ongoing matter that's of high importance is, should he say execute, hit it, or manifest for his trademark, you know, his make it so kind of thing.
Punch engage.
It, you know. Yeah. Yeah.
This is important captainly stuff. You gotta have a really good, cool, you know, catchphrase.
Yeah. I'm unclear as a little side note. I had to think about this a little bit. I'm not sure what my catchphrase would be as captain. I settled on get it done, which maybe sounds a little negative.
I would have gone full Nike and just gone with do it.
Right.
So Stamets comes and says that, hey, they have some interesting details based on the Nevar data, Nevar being the combined Romulan and Vulcan from Unification 3 homeworld. The burn started in, I wrote Berubin Nebula. I don't know if I got that right from the subtitles. I didn't pause.
Hang on, I have it right here. It was, yes, the Berubin Nebula.
Right. And so Adira pipes in and says, this is a deliberate signal. It's in the audio range that's coming from the nebula. It sounds like music. And it's the same music that the Barzans from the episode with the Seed Vault and Gray hummed, you know, or played the music that we're talking about. And Saru just like really feels the music here. He's getting into this this EDM. And it apparently, when they filter out any disturbances and synchronize things all appropriately, it sounds like a Federation distress signal. Maybe there's a Federation ship in there calling for help. And Stamets says, well, you know, Adira's good at the algorithms. She can write something up that, that lickety split that can analyze this and figure it out. And this is where we have Adira say, yo, by the way, it's not she's fast, they're fast. She doesn't feel like a she, prefers they or them. So this more neatly aligns, given earlier discussions we have with this character or with Elliot Page, just more neatly aligns the actor versus the character that has come out here. But simplifies things a whole lot.
Yeah, now we don't have to jump back and forth between the character and the person. That helps. Thank you for that, writers. We appreciate that.
Yeah, it's definitely easier. And so it's all taken in stride. And I think the rest of the episode, they all use they when talking about Adira.
A beautiful scene further on, I'm not going to spoil it, but a beautiful scene further on between Culber and Stamets where they flawlessly use they, them. It's magic. It's like, it's perfect.
Right. So back to a different hallway, Michael and Book are walking and talking, and she's like, yo, this whole time we were together, how come you never mentioned a brother? He's like, well, actually, it's not my blood brother. He's my brother from another mother, kind of thing, right? Like that's a word we used because of how close we were dealing with things on our planet. And we've also got on the bridge, Owo and Detmer talking about the programmable matter interface that they have upgrade for the disco, and how it's supposed to just change itself to whatever you need, but that Detmer has been getting engineering to tinker with it to say, look, I need fail safes, all right? I can't have, I need a known thing that it's going to do when the stress comes.
Well, yeah, because she had the big freeze up in the previous episode, right? Where she had the jitters and was afraid that she was going to end up getting people hurt, right?
Yeah. So Saru says, all right, let's go to Black Alert and execute, which...
and everyone looks at him sideways.
Yeah, even nobody after does the work, anything. Yeah, they just stand there.
Even with the workshopping with Tilly, that one didn't go so well with the crowd. The Discovery jumps to Quajan. And Jonathan, you'd asked about the like spinning and then flipping down. Like they had more straightforward shots this time. It looked like traditional disco going through the spore drive thing. Is yeah. This in line with your thoughts from last episode?
Was the pod bay or whatever it's called, was the door open again this time? Did seem to get a lot of people upset on the Twitterverse.
Yeah, it didn't look like it, but I think we were looking at it from top down view when it arrived at the planet. We just sort of saw the top view, but I think it was more sort of the traditional sort of arrival. I honestly, the more that it occurred to me after we spoke about it last week, the more I thought, you know, we joked about them not going to Nevar, but that they did the whole ceremony inside the ship, and then you know they honestly feels like maybe they were just trying to cut some corners on the effects budget. That was their effects budget savings episode, so maybe they just did like a really fast jump and didn't do the full effect. They were trying to save some money for a bigger pew 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 episode later on.
Well, like this one.
Yeah maybe.
Yeah, this is the old George Reeve Superman where he would like run, jump, and the camera would cut, and then he's just already horizontal in the air. They don't show the transition because that costs money.
Absolutely. It's the Flash, right? The Flash, some papers go flying off a desk. And then they cut the camera and he's standing there like, oh yeah, Flash just ran in the room. Look at him, he's tired.
Right. So when the Discovery arrives at Kwajan, they see that long-range sensors say that Osiris cruiser is coming and it's armed to the teeth. So Michael and Booker have to head to the planet real fast, down for the bridge and everything. Try not to cause too much trouble, right? The Federation is kind of in a very weird spot with having their ship there and Michael Burnham on the planet. Georgiou goes into sick bay in her space pants to get analyzed, see what's going up with her. We see all sorts of weird stuff in her mind's eye, and she just like yells out, you know, it's kind of a tense situation. Oh, I'm sorry, I wrote that wrong. That's actually, I misremembered. That's later. Well, forget what I just said. my actual note here was how she is told like count back from like 100 or 10 or something.
Yeah,
like,
count back from 10. Yeah,
it's like that's stupid. Like, at any point, and just falls asleep instantly. Right? It's like that's how good the meds are in the future. Yeah. So we get a nice scene with Adira playing the cello with Stamets, and we learn that Gray's not talking to Adira anymore, and that Adira isn't able to elegantly handle the different previous hosts that are in there. I don't know if I knew that Stamets plays the piano. I don't know if that had come up before, but it reminded me here that he does, if it has been mentioned.
Yeah, no, I think he, after Colbert died, I think they did at some point have him talking about that.
Okay. Different scene. We've got Rin the Andorian coming in to talk with Saru and Tilly. He's got all sorts of attitude. He wants off the ship. He definitely has trust issues when it comes to the Federation, Starfleet. Tilly tells him, by the way, the Viridian, oh, I misspelled it here. The Viridian is coming. So you got to help us out because bad stuff, right? We also learned that the scanners and etc. don't work due to scrambler defenses around the sanctuary. Mm-hmm. So they're not going to be able to just transport in and out super easy. And these scanner defenses and other defense systems will come in play later in the episode. We see the beautiful sea locusts, which kind of remind me of the Will-O-Wisps from Brave.
Yeah, they reminded me of Avatar. There's this scene when they are out in the jungle at night and there are these little sort of things floating around like little jellyfish in the air.
Yeah, yeah. We are reminded here, because it's been quite a few episodes, that Booker is future Aquaman. He can, as an empath, he can talk to these kinds of creatures. And they're ambushed in the forest. He says, put your hands up. Michael's like, what? It's like, oh no, obviously he knows that his people are there. And Booker's brother is like, you brought the Federation with you, Terex? What the heck is going on? He's like, no, I'm going, I go with Booker now. Right? And this is where we switch over to Georgiou waking up while she's seeing the bad images going on, and her whole freaky matter face distortion thing is happening as she sees the images. But she does walk away with a fragment in her hand as she exits the medical bay. This takes us back down to the planet where Kaheem, which is the name of the brother, and Booker talk about the current situation. It turns out that Osira wants Rin, and it's kind of not in a good place to turn her down, because as we mentioned before, this is what the Emerald Chain does, right? They have you over a barrel. You've got to do what they want. Otherwise, they're not going to give you the tech that will save your planet. In this case, the tech that deals with the sea locusts in some way. Otherwise, there's going to be a huge famine for them, for the planet. And we up the ante here, where the Viridian has arrived, scans USS Discovery, allows itself to be scanned as a show of force, you know, in a very passive way of like, yeah, check out how many guns we got. Saru, you know, sends his message to Michael of like, hey, bad things are going to happen here, right? Osira says hello. She hasn't seen a Starfleet vessel in a while. It claims that Rin is a wanted criminal, and Saru's like, we're not aware of anybody who is officially recognized by the Federation who would consider him a criminal, so I don't believe you. Kaheem is super mad. He glows yellow on his face when he's tempted to punch Booker. So we see that he too has the empath abilities. This will be important later in the episode. Turns out back on the ship that Rin was apparently on a lifelong quote contract that he broke, which Saru's like, dude, that's slavery. What are you talking about? Yeah. Lifelong contract. There's a little bit of Kelpian focused racism here, and a standoff with a 5-minute grace period of like, if you don't hand him over within 5 minutes, you're gonna blow stuff up. And Kaheem, the brother of Booker, gets a little telephone call from Osira. She wants Booker and whoever he came with, right? Kaheem has his doubts, but she's like, guess what? You have a child, right? You know what's terrible for children? When they starve to death from a famine.
Yeah, it's some cold stuff.
Yeah, it's super dark. And she lays on the pressure as the Viridian opens fire on the planet, and this is not good, right? She's trying to poke through the defenses that they have, but Booker has a plan. Back over on Discovery, Saru and Tilly ask Rin, why does Osira want him so bad that she would just pelt this planet with torpedoes? I think it's here where he says that he knows about her whole deal, right?
It's later on, at this point he's sort of playing I don't know, and yeah, it's not until after the crisis is over that he confesses it to Tilly, right?
Yeah, I apologize, it's so hard because they cut back and forth.
Yeah, it's a lot of cuts in this episode. I did not envy you doing the recap. They cut a lot back and forth.
There's so much. Yeah, so sorry for the accidental spoilers for like 5 minutes down the line. In this case, Saru's like, all right, we need to get weapons hot. And Mr. Reese, weapons officer's like, yo, Admiral Vance told us he didn't want weapons to get hot. Like, we can't be shooting here. He's like, all right, you know, we just want to be prepared, right? Just, we're not intentionally going to go shoot, but like, we can't be caught here with our pants down.
Yeah.
Switch over to Giorgio, who takes her fragment that she had taken for the sick bay to get analyzed. He's getting some info, and red alert happens. Culber brings the cops. He's like, you know, we got to deal with this situation, right? We can't have you going off and getting yourself into a situation like Michael almost died because you weren't medically ready the last time.
Yeah, and she's pretty blunt about it too. Not that she isn't always blunt, but just sort of says, you know, I'm dying, what does it matter?
Right. So Rin, the Andorian, speaks up on the weakness that he's aware of for the Viridian. This is here where Lieutenant Nielsen says, yo, they can't fire upon the ship or it will be seen as an attack by the Federation, right? This is very much not a good idea. But Tilly says, well, a non-Federation ship could fire upon them, and with a pilot, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, who would be heavily disciplined for going rogue. Smash cut over to Detmer, who's going rogue with Rin. They have all the pew pew pews as their ship attacks the Viridian from like hyper close range. This reminds me a bit of DS9, where in the mirror universe the Defiant is flying super close to a mirror version of the Defiant is flying super close to the mirror version of the Negvar Klingon ship, and just so close that they can't effectively fire back, right? It's not meant to handle somebody so close. And while things are going on with Detmer and Rin, Grudge comes out, scares the bejesus out of Rin. He's like, what the heck is this? Like, oh, it's fine, it's just like a cat. He's like, is that like a pet? What is that? What is this?
Is it sitting on his lap? Yeah. That was a funny scene.
I mean, who knows, right? I mean, it's space stuff. I wouldn't know if some random worm was like, oh, don't touch that, it's heavily poisonous. Oh, really? Just looks like a bird.
Yeah.
So she like, Kaheem wants you back. I don't know why I wrote that. I apologize.
Okay, because that's what they're trying to, because Michael and Book escape, right? They take off and then Kaheem comes after them. They get dropped by the like five other people or whatever.
That's right. This is in that forest there when they're running around on. Okay, yeah, right. So Michael and Booker end up fighting Kaheem's crew with the sticks and like dart gun crossbow sort of thing.
Yeah,
like
very cool design.
Yeah. Back on the fighter ship here, Detmer has her self-realization moment that she can deal, you know, even with difficult things. It seems like her kind of working her way through her trauma that she had from early in the season. Mm-hmm. And she decides to go full manual instead of having the ship, you know, autopilot itself. So that's kind of a cool thing. So it's not the joystick that we saw in Star Trek Insurrection. This is kind of more like an HTC Vive or some other VR sort of thing.
Exactly, looked like to me.
A little bit more modern there.
Yeah.
Eventually, back on the planet, Kaheem comes into play. He drop kicks Booker. Tangles with Booker's got a blade on him, but you know Michael's got a gun on him, so Michael and Booker get the drop on Kaheem. Back in space, Star Wars moves happen where there's like a tiny vent or something that is the weakness, and the pew pew pews happen, and the Viridian is forced to stand down because it's in a world of hurt given by this attack again for the weakness that Rin was privy to. And Saru is like the cat who ate the canary. He's like, hey, so looks like you're in some trouble. We can help you if you want. Right? But the Viridian ends up, peacing out of there. And Kaim's like,
with a pretty scary threat on the way out the door, right?
Yeah. I'll get you Gadget next time.
It will be bad, she says. It will be bad.
Yeah. And down on the planet, having seen the Viridian warp out, Kaim says, "We're going to starve, my son." Ooh. And Michael's like, "Wait a minute. What if you guys use your Wonder Twin powers to make the sea locust leave?" Like, okay, I mean, we're not strong enough to do that. It'd be really powerful. And they say, well, okay, what if we use the power of science to make a more powerful empath play here?
Yeah, whatever this technology is that we've never seen before, we'll make it stronger.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like a psychic megaphone is what I would assume it is.
Which you have on board a ship, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, you make a conical shape. It's the tinfoil hat, but instead of covering top in,
you
it's just like...
reconfigure the deflector array, you know.
No, it's like an Elizabethan collar on your head, right? Just something makes all the beams go out, and they get the "shall I execute?" going back to that, and he's like, "Carry on," which is, you know, kind of neat, you know. It's very subtle, nuanced, and you know, good things happen there with the aforementioned beam and their ability to convince the locusts to leave so that the famine doesn't happen. No, well done, both of you. Medals for everyone. We go over to the mess hall where Detmer is very happy. They've got the bridge crew. They're eating and having some fun about all of this stuff and how big Detmer's head's getting now that she's getting past this issue she's had. And, poor Rin is just the weird kid in the cafeteria eating alone. So Tilly goes over and eats with him. And Rin says, like, "Look, I thought the Federation was this terrible, deceitful thing as I grew up. They if you were a bad Andorian child, they'd threaten you with, like, we're going to send you to Starfleet summer camp." And like, well, that doesn't exist. Right? It's just like a thing. And Rin reveal. Okay, here's where Rin reveals why. Okay, I'd gotten myself all mixed up. Rin finally does reveal why Osira and the chain are so interested in getting him. And it's because he's the only one who knows that the chain is running out of dilithium, which, for folks who don't remember from early on, they need that dilithium so that the whole courier system can work, right? You can't bend people over barrels if you don't have some ability to get the materials they need for their, you know, their planet situation to them. So the whole system is going to break down. So now, not only does Rin know, but now Tilly knows this secret. And Kaim brings his son on board the Discovery, walking by Linus, who I don't think we had mentioned was going through his, like, shedding his skin phase.
Yeah,
so gross. This will become important in a couple of minutes. The brothers have their moment of understanding, which is good. And in order to have that moment, the private mode of understanding, Michael's like, "Hey, you know, let me take your son over here." And she's like, "Hey, little kid, would you like to meet Linus, the weird lizard guy you noticed? You can peel some skin off his face," which kind of weird, but like, I probably would want to do that as a kid.
Totally. 100% as a kid would have done that.
Yeah, yeah. This is where we have the nice scene with Culber going over to see Stamets in engineering, Adiris asleep at their desk because they've been trying really hard to write that algorithm to analyze the burn signal. They're saying all sorts of good thing about them, and Adira wakes up and has heard the adulation from the adults. And really well done on this scene.
Yeah, it is such a quietly important scene. It just beautifully acted by those two performers. Like, I was thinking about it as I was watching. I was thinking, like, I love how beautifully normal the scene is. It's not, there's no overemphasis. There's no sort of ridiculous, you know, making a big statement. It was just beautifully, elegantly acted by two very, very talented men. I thought that was such a perfect way to do that.
Yeah, I think well done to the writers too, because I think the real world implication here was that, or context, I should not implication, was that I think the actor was struggling with this themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why early episodes it was she, her. Mm-hmm. And I guess at some point they figured it out and talked with the writers, and they included this, like, okay, well, let's make it very straightforward for your character then, right? They, them then is totally fine. And they, kudos to them for being able to write that in without, you know, ham fisting it in there as could be done in other situations.
No, like I say, it was exactly enough. enough. It was just perfect. And I thought about it in the moment too, that just, I love those two. I like, they're my one of my favorite couples on TV. I love them. They're so charming and their love seems so genuine.
Indeed, indeed. Final scene of this episode is Michael and Booker talking about the situation, especially because, you know, this is Booker's home and clearly he's got, you know, some semblance of family here. And he's like, no, you know, this whole thing you're going into, Michael, basically, you know, saving the universe one episode at a time. I'm here with you for that. I'm here along for the ride. You know, aye, Captain. It's like, no, it's one eye. We're not pirates. Right? They didn't say it this time, but I think she had said it earlier when he had to put on the uniform and in some other episode to fake it, right? It's one eye, not I. Only pirates say that. And she, you know, she leaves the ship and very happy that he's going to be sticking around.
Yeah, so are we supposed to infer that he is now going to try to become a member of the crew full-time? Is that the implication?
That's kind of how I heard it.
Yeah, I think he's basically Neelix, if you can bear with me here, right? So...
Or Guinan, yeah.
He's this yeah, I went with Neelix as being a little closer because of the, you know, a ship ends up in this place it knows nothing about, right? Very similar to Voyager for Disco. They've moved to the future.
Oh,
they know nothing. They've got a local who has their own ship that's in the shuttle bay. Granted, he doesn't have like a lady, that's a different character. In this case, it's Michael that he brought back into the fold. But again, very similar to like Kes and Neelix sort of situation, right? Right? And where Neelix was kind of just his own dude, only there because it was convenient, but eventually becomes a valuable member of the crew. I could totally see Booker being Disco's version of Neelix. You know, he can help clue them into, oh yeah, here's the actual, like, this is what the official records say, but this is the actual situation of what's going on here, right? He can still give valuable intelligence to them.
Right.
Yeah.
And cook occasionally.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or the cafeteria. I mean, interesting episode. Not quite as deep or convoluted as the last two episodes were. I thought this was pretty straightforward as far as episodes go. I mean, the pew-pew stuff with Detmer in the middle, for a little bit of action, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
The sci-fi budget, like you said.
Yeah, and it was a nice step forward. We talked about it in the earlier episodes, that there's always a danger in episodic television of sort of, you know, problem one week, whitewash the next week, it's gone. The fact that they've stayed with Detmer as a secondary character, she is sort of on that second tier of characters on the show, but to have continued her issues from beginning to now, and then to sort of have this be the catharsis, was, I think, a really nice piece of storytelling. And it was also a nice opportunity for that actor to also have a chance to shine and sort of, you know, grow the character a little bit and make her more relevant. I was thinking about Jaime's joke, though, when they always, you know, they focus on a character, they're going to get snuffed at the next week. I was like, oh man, I hope they don't kill Detmer now.
Yeah, I thought that ship was blowing up for sure. I thought for sure that ship was blazing. Oh no, she's talking a lot this episode. That's that's not good.
I had the same concern when Lieutenant Nilsson started speaking roles, and she had a couple of good lines in this one. I'm like, uh-oh, shh, be quiet, stay in the background.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So what are the big questions of this one? The one that popped into my mind was, okay, so obviously this one focused on Book and there's some good character development. The George Aus stuff seems like it's set up for next episode, where we're going to get more, try and understand exactly what's going on with her. We got another flashback. We heard that the name San come out again. So we're going to get into that. But I think the sort of quietest part of this episode was more about the mystery of the burn, right? We now know that it did originate from a place. We now know that it is in that nebula, and we know that there's this mysterious signal coming from the nebula that may or may not be a Federation starship. So then that becomes sort of the next puzzle piece. Do you guys have any theories? Because I might have one.
Yeah, I kind of wondered why they didn't just say, well, let's go rescue them like they tend to do, right? So
yeah, I mean, I guess because they were sort of out on the road when this all sort of shook out, right? But
yeah, I mean, it was sort of an interesting or odd setup from the get-go, because because, you know, here is, you know, Vance has already given them, scolded them for running off the last time they did this. Was it just last episode? I can't remember.
Two episodes ago.
And he's like, you know, you're we can't, you're a valuable resource. We can't have you running around the universe. You'll do what I tell you to do, kind of thing. And then here we are. Oh, you know, let's take this problem to Vance and discuss, you know, running off to solve this problem. I thought it was kind of odd that after the whole discussion about, you know, you go where I go, where I tell you to go, you go on the missions I tell you to go on, that they're now, they would go to him with this sort of, you know, story about Booker and how like, why wouldn't they just throw Booker and Detmer and burn them into his ship and have them go off and fight this thing? Is it because they couldn't get there fast enough? Is that the idea? They had to use Discovery's war drive?
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah, and it's funny, they turned Vance around really fast in this one, because he's been a bit of a hard ass. And this one, he's like, I'm not risking the spore drive. And then within like 15 seconds, he's like, all right, take the spore drive and go.
Well, that's what I mean. Like, the whole setup was odd. I mean, you know, having to go to ask Dad if they can borrow the car kind of deal, you know, after he's just told them you're never going to borrow the car you're grounded for a month, you know, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was odd sort of setup. I just found that a little sort of strange that they could just, you know, go there. Either they're going to wander around and do science-y kind of stuff and just occasionally get into, you know, into situations where they got some splaining to do, you know, but that should be the that's kind of how they were before. They were just kind of wandering around, you know, measuring stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
And getting involved with emperors and whatever. But here they're sort of, you know, they've been given a desk job in the new Federation. And like Kirk, they occasionally want to jump in and run off and solve a problem, right? So kind of odd, you know?
So what ship makes sense for it to be at the center of all this? If it's a Federation ship that may have inadvertently caused all this.
That Ferengi shuttle from that.
Those guys are everywhere.
Huh?
Those guys are everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. The what ship?
I have two ideas that could make sense. One is the disco itself through some timey-wiminess, and this is tied into the short trek where
Calypso,
where the disco has been abandoned and left in a nebula for like 1,000 years.
Yep.
So this is one of those, again, Doctor Who style timey-wimey. What the heck? How is it? I don't remember you, Doctor. Yeah, I don't remember you either, Doctor. Well, that can't both be true, right? And chaos ensues.
Mm-hmm.
The second one was maybe I have this wrong. The ship that which Lorca am I thinking of? Prime Lorca was on, right? So it's so crossing back over from the mirror universe, right? Because we know that they had like swapped, and I didn't bother to look up to see how they resolved if they did what Prime Lorca was up to, because that would also be a WTF moment of like, what, Lorca, get that guy? No, that's not the same guy. It's a different guy. I don't even know who you people are.
You guys have completely forgotten about Harry Mudd.
I would be all in if they could do that, but I just don't think that's the case.
Yeah. Well, wasn't he doing, in his short trek, wasn't he doing some sort of weird traveling around? Like, did he find Burnham's, time traveling suit? Remember that episode? He was sort of coming and going and collecting things.
Yeah,
it was a left field. I was starting off as a joke, but then I was thinking about it. It's like, you know, wait a minute.
Yeah, that could be a fun one too. But Jonathan, what did you have?
Yeah, I mean, my mind immediately went to the Calypso episode because of the nebula, right? Like when they specifically said nebula, I was like, wasn't that where Disco was lost and the ship had evolved and, you know, things had gone awry? So that's immediately where my mind went, was, well, is this a different version of the Disco? Is it alternate universe Disco? Is it, they've gone to the even farther flung future and then come back or something? To me, I was a little, I was not quite sure what to make of that. But the term nebula, when they started talking about the nebula, that really sort of tweaked me to like, well, how would that work? How could that work? You're right, Jaime. I think it might be a timey-wimey thing, which again makes me a little queasy. But I can't think of what other circumstances would make sense. Like, what else could it be that would be, you know, like, I feel like it needs, like, it almost feels like a paradox, right? Like, it almost feels like, well, we can't came to the future, and now we have to figure out a way to stop ourselves from doing whatever it is that caused this thing, and therefore we'll actually have fixed the future. But I get it. It's hard to determine, you know, like, is this show going to stay in this time frame forever? Are they going to, you know, like, what's the future of this show? Where do they go from here? It's hard to get a gauge on, you know, I think when we started watching Discovery, we weren't sure what we were getting ourselves into. You know, we knew that it was sort of a precursor to, you know, between Enterprise and the original series. Now it's sort of evolved past that into this far-flung future adventure. You know, who's to say next season it doesn't completely switch gears again and they have to go timey-wimey and they end up, you know, further in the future or into the past or something else happens, right?
Yeah. And if you remember from one or two episodes ago, I said they somehow go to the past with the disco and Giorgio falls out of... falls off the ship and ends up back in time for the Section 31 show. Since it wasn't clear if she was going to stick around here for Section 31 or end up back in her era.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how they play that. You know, obviously they don't have to set it in the same, you know, sort of timeline. It could be, oh, this is what happened to Georgia, you know, while she was with Section 31 before she came aboard the Disco and went into the future. But given the sort of advancement of the character this season and that they're still sort of paying attention to her and her storyline, and it seems like next episode is going to really focus on her and her illness. I wonder if that makes sense, if, you know, there's a way that she's going to end up, you know, hey, she's going to die if she stays here. We have to find a way to send her back to her own universe, or we have to find a way to send her back in time to a place where she's not, you know, all weirding out with her face all distorting and stuff like that. But either way, as we start sort of creeping, you know, we're past the halfway point of the season, we've sort of, you know, started to unravel these pieces. It feels like that the mystery of the burn hopefully will get some resolution this season. We still do have a few more episodes to go, so it's not like it's over with, but it'll be interesting to see what that is and what the consequence of it is too, because if it comes down to, you know, the cause of the burn is a Federation ship and the Federation is the cause of its own downfall, then that's an interesting ramification too.
Right. Yeah, I think some of the things that came together in this episode is I fully expect that Michael and Saru can just waltz into Vance's office and just dunk on him and be like, oh, remember this thing you didn't want us to figure out the source of the burn? One, turns out it's a Federation ship in the middle of it, so you think about going and trying to save it. And two, you would have the, by the way, I know from your perspective, oh, the burn was this thing from 100 plus years ago. Why do we even care what happened? Let's just deal with the effect. Now they can say, well, actually, part of the effect is the various tenuous grip that the Emerald Chain has that's sort of keeping things not totally civilized, because very clearly they're taking advantage of people, but at least people can get stuff that they need from these criminals and pirates courier type system. What happens when they run out of dilithium and now everybody's cut off and isolated, and what happens there? Mm-hmm. Right. So I feel like you have some vindication of Michael's obsession with solving the burn here, that she's more correct in the idea, like, if we don't solve the problem of the burn, we're never going to have a stabilized, reunited Federation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, all things being equal, this felt like a glue episode. It was about exposition. It was about getting Book to buy into the Starfleet stuff. It was about more connecting the mystery of the burn. It was more about, you know, it was more about building, you know, Detmer's resolution of Detmer's storyline, Tilly starting to show her stuff, Saru doing his thing. Like, it just felt like it was a good episode, but it wasn't a substantial one. It was about moving things forward, not about really making a huge impression, I think.
Yeah, that's true. So it says here on Wikipedia, we have up through episode 13, which will take us to January 7th of 2021. Mm-hmm. I was curious if this is a 13 or 14 season episode. Looks like it's 13.
13, yeah. And so no part two for the first episode either. If you look at the titles, they have all the titles for all the episodes, and there's no part two to the season debut, which was a part one.
Right, right.
Yeah, I wonder if that ends up being the first episode of season four that we know that they're going to do.
Or the last of season four, right? Like, maybe it's a bookend of this sort of timeline where they are now.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, We'll see where it goes. Yep. So this was this is episode 8 of 13. So, you know, we still have a ways to go.
5 more to go. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Alrighty. Well, let's move off to our watch list. And Jaime, you're up first.
Yeah. One that's been pretty pertinent given what has happened this season in Discovery. This is Steve Shives. I like a lot of his Star Trek videos. And this one is entitled, "Does Star Trek Actually Believe in the Chain of Command?"
Right.
It's kind of a doozy. We've talked about, you know, admirals going rogue, captains going rogue, people who are first officers like Michael Burnham going rogue, and whether somebody like Tilly should fill in on that role. And so I think this is a fun video. It's kind of longer as far as YouTube videos go, 25 minutes, but it's good. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's a fair premise. I'm going to check that one out because I think it's...
Well, we've also had generals and stuff like that go rogue too, like in Undiscovered Country and stuff like that, right? So
Yeah.
Next one, brought to you by Will Wheaton.
Yeah, I think, you know, the book Ready Player One was a big hit, came out about 10 years ago. The audiobook, as Tim mentioned, was narrated by or read by Will Wheaton.
Will Wheaton.
And it was good. I thought it was quite enjoyable, very pop culture-y. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the movie was Steven Spielberg directed the film version, which was good but not great. I thought it was certainly serviceable. Enjoyed it. Lots of fan service in there, lots of properties, but then because it had some scenes in the book that wouldn't have translated well to a big screen environment, some of it had to change.
It seemed to it lost the whole sort of challenge of games, you know,
video
games in the day, like, you know, figuring out these Easter eggs and figuring out, you know, how to beat bosses. That was sort of underplayed in the movie or not played at all.
Yeah. Right? And again, I guess I understand it from a storytelling point of view. It's far more interesting to have the big, you know, I'm driving Marty McFly's DeLorean and a race while my friend is driving the Bigfoot truck. Yeah, exactly. Like it's far sexier to do it that way. So I completely understand why you make those choices for a film adaptation. But I think the book was a very satisfying exploration of not just pop culture, but also, just sort of the culture of video games. And that, to bring that all around, Ready Player 2, the sequel by Ernest Cline, is now available. So if you want to pick up a copy, available on your local bookstores, which I highly endorse you supporting during this pandemic. Mm-hmm. And also, if you're so inclined, the audiobook version is available as well. I have
narrated by Will Wheaton.
Is it? I haven't checked out.
Yeah, I heard a preview just before we started recording, and I went to check it out.
Yeah,
reserve it at my library. And
yeah, I was going to ask, are you going to download that one to the library?
Well, no, I've been going to the Toronto Library to get my audiobooks lately.
Oh, so, I see. See, you don't have your Audible account anymore.
I do, but I don't pay into it. So
yeah. But yeah, it's definitely something that's on my to-do list. I don't know. I've got some time off over the holidays. I think maybe I'll make an effort to put in my earbuds and listen to Ready Player 2. I've seen a few initial reviews that were sort of up and down. Some people liked it, some people didn't. So I'll be curious to make my own assessments of that one. But yeah, Ready Player 2, Ernest Cline, definitely worth a check out.
For sure.
Has this sequel been in development, in the writing for quite some time?
I think he had been, I don't know that it was in his intention to necessarily do it. I think he did something in the interim, but yeah, they announced that he was going to do this like a few years back, that it was coming.
Okay, so that seems to track, because I was like, I could have sworn a friend of mine who told me about how much they like Ready Player One, I think before the movie was even made, was excited for the prospect of Ready Player Two. And I was like, I saw your pic here, and I was like, this book is new? I was like, how is it new?
Yeah.
But that sort of fills the gap there. Yeah.
And it'll be interesting to see if, I don't know how successful, or if it was successful in the way that they had anticipated or hoped that Ready Player One was as a film, if this will be something that they will want to sequelize as well, if this is going to be something that is, you know, now a franchise, or if this is something where, you know, the movie worked as the movie and that's the end of the story.
Right. Cool. All right. Well, my pick is kind of ties into the very first story of this episode, in that it's a website set up by somebody who has put a little question and answer thing. We have a lot of these kind of things on resources on More Than Just Code as our pick. This is, can you watch HBO Max? And it's, you know, tap here to find out if you can or not. And it asks you a series of questions, like, you know, the first one is, asks, have you got something to watch TV on? Yes, I do. And then have you got something, you know, are you in the United States? No, I'm not. Oh, sorry, I'm out of luck, right? But Jaime could carry on with the by answering yes, and then carry on down the choices in terms of like whether or not you get it free with your current cable or your some other provider, or whether you'll have to pay for it or not. But just sort of a fun little tool here, since HBO Max is suddenly a big story today. This guy threw up this website to quickly determine whether or not you are in fact able to watch HBO Max. There you go. Fun times.
Yep. Yeah, I looked up to see HBO Max Roku channel, and as of November 12th or something, the answer was no, there is no official one, but you can use the AirPlay from the iOS app to do that. So I'll do that presumably, unless they, and this would be a really rinky-dink move, unless they remove that from the app. I don't remember if you can opt out of all of AirPlay from an iOS app, but it would be a really, really crappy move if HBO were to come out with an app update right before Wonder Woman comes out.
Yeah, I mean, you think it would be in their interest now that they've gone this route to ramp up all efforts possible to get HBO Max as a service on any device that you could possibly put it on. As you say, I may put it on your toaster. I think they want everybody to have it everywhere so that they can monetize the heck out of it, because they're talking about, you know, sum total of those, you know, 17 movies or whatever it is like, you know, a couple $1 billion in investment as far as your costs sunk already. Mm. So I think they want everybody to have this on their smart toaster.
Yep. Yes, siree. So I guess that's it for another week. So hey, Jonathan, if people want to get in touch with you, where would they find you?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram as at JPK News.
All right. And how many people want to get in touch with you?
I'm on Twitter as at Dev of the Hair.
All right. My name is Tim Mitra, T-I-M-M-I-T-R-A, on the Twitter machine is where you'll find me. So until next time, we'll see you in the future. Bye.
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 You've been listening to the Spotcast Podcast. This is Jean-Luc Picard.
Shut up, Wesley.
Sorry, say again. Just the tag. Gotcha. If you want to find out more about the podcast or see the episode show notes, visit the Spotcast website at spotcast.com. You can get in touch with us on the website or follow us on Twitter at Spotcast. If you have feedback or questions, send us a tweet with the hashtag AskSpotcast. If you like the show, please consider recommending us to a friend, writing a review on iTunes, or pledging any amount at patreon.com/Spotcast. You can find details on how to help us on our website, spotcast.com/sponsor us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the future.
I did watch that Comedy Store show that you put us on to last week, John.
Oh yeah, what'd you think of it?
It's pretty good.
Yeah, I found it petered out a little bit. I really enjoyed the first three.
Yeah,
and then the fourth one, I was like, it's okay. And
the fourth one was sort of like within the pandemic too, right? It was sort of
And then the final episode was the one where they all sort of gather around and are sort of trading stories.
That was the fourth one, wasn't it?
No, that was the fifth one. I think that was the final one. But that was the one, because the one before that was the weird one with Joe Rogan versus Carlos Mencia.
Yeah,
the whole like, Rogan got kicked out of the club and he wasn't supposed to come back because he pointed out the fact that Mencia was stealing everybody else's jokes. And that was a weird, like, it felt like an important part, but I didn't care that much. And
yeah, it was interesting too, because I think I told you that the story or the TV show or book or whatever called I'm Dying Up Here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The show
was written around the same sort of idea. Like this female character who runs this comedy store. A couple of the comedians who were actually in this show are play comedians in the story, right? Which, so it was really weird to sort of see them, but you really are a stand-up comedian. Yeah. And it's amazing how many people kind of went through that particular place. Because I knew about the improv and I knew about this place.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I didn't know this was sort of the proving ground. Did the improv pay people, or was it sort of a free stand-up thing there too? Or?
Yeah, I don't know if that was sort of the standard way of doing things. Jaime, I don't know if you have a chance to watch yet, but there's a really interesting interesting part where they talk about how the comedians used to not get paid anything. Like, nobody who worked there really got paid. They all used to do it just for the stage time and for the experience and for the exposure. And at a certain point, they all go on strike and basically say, like, we have to start getting paid because all the money was basically being funneled back into the owners of the owner of the club. And
oh, she was making $100,000 a week, right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
So they were like, okay, you can break some of that off for us. And so they literally went and walked the picket line outside the club. And it wasn't like nobody. It was like Letterman and Leno. Like,
yeah.
It was pretty big time at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting to see. I mean, because I knew all those people started. And it was sort of Jimmy Walker was sort of the first guy to get a TV show out of it and out of the whole experience.
And then, well, and Freddie Prinze, the whole Freddie Prinze story. Yeah. And
oh, Freddie Prinze is tragic. I remember Freddie Prinze. I watched every episode of Chico and the Man when it was on, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess your perspective on this would be, you know, I think interesting compared to mine. I mean, mine is obviously I watch a lot of those 70s shows in reruns when I was a kid in the 80s, but I didn't live it the way that you probably had more sort of knowledge of this whole sort of time, the whole the Tonight Show with the, you know, all the different actors, the comedians and stuff like that. And
yeah. Well, so it's funny because, you know, like take Good Times, for example, right? Mm. So Esther Rolle was Maud's, Maud came out of Archie Bunker. She was Archie Bunker's sister-in-law, right? Mm-hmm. Or no, Edith. She was related to Edith. And so that, you know, Bea Arthur and Adrienne Barbeau were sort of the main characters there. Mm-hmm. And then their housekeeper was Esther Rolle, who was the mother on Good Times. So when they spun that off, when Norman Lear spun that off, you would have thought that it was sort of the Esther Rolle show, and her husband, I've forgotten his name now.
It was John Amos, wasn't it?
John Amos, yeah. He was quite popular in that as well.
Well, but he'd been Jimmy on Roots, Walker, right?
Yeah.
Right? He was on Roots, too, in that same
era.
He
was on Good Times before Roots.
Oh, was he? Yeah.
Yeah. And then the... But the vehicle was around Jimmy Walker and his sort of presence, right? Yeah. So he became the sort of I think it was, I can't remember if Good Times came before Chico and the Man. They were around the same time, mm-hmm. right? Chico and the Man was obviously Freddie Prinze and Albert something or other, the old man. Anyway, you know, and that was sort of that was the first time, you know, we saw any kind of Chicano on television, you know? Mm. And there was Sanford and Sons was another similar type of show like that too with Fred Fox, right?
Fred Fox, yeah.
But yeah, it was interesting to sort of see that. But I want to come back to Tom and Jerry, which we talked about at the beginning of the show. And because I remember somebody once asked me, and I can't remember if it was you or Xavier asked me, why did we watch the Brady Bunch when we were kids? Or why did we watch shows like Gilligan's Island? And the answer is because there was nothing else on.
Yeah, that's what was on, yeah.
Right, you know, so you kind of watched that. And Tom and Jerry was sort of the cheaper version of Looney Tunes. You'd watch, you know, Bugs Bunny and Roadrunner and that kind of stuff, because that was around the time Roadrunner came into the Looney Tunes, right? Mm-hmm. Wile E. Coyote and all that kind of stuff. And Tom and Jerry was another, I think Tom and Jerry was on Sunday mornings, and it was sort of, you know, you watch the cat, and they're from, like, they were movies from, or they were like, they were shorts, I guess, that were shown before.
Yeah, before the movies, back in the 40s.
Movies, yeah. But in the 70s, they were made into like a TV show, and you would watch these little, you know, 5-10 minute long episodes. Mm-hmm. Right, with Monsieur Le Petit Cat and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, so but Tom and Jerry was like a kind of a big deal, right? But I didn't get the reference to why they're coming back to, are they being made into a movie or something like that for HBO? Mm-hmm. Or,
yeah, and or it's the mixed CGI live animation like Smurfs or Garfield.
No way.
Yeah, which is a very strange choice.
Mm-hmm. So they're going to dip the cat into red dye or something like that.
Yeah, it's funny because the Tom and Jerry was always the one too. Like Tom and Jerry was the inspiration for Itchy and Scratchy on The Simpsons too.
Yes,
the idea of like the violence level of those versus the Looney Tunes was like. I mean, Looney Tunes obviously, you know, Elmer Fudd and Yosemite Sam used to fire guns at
the Barbara Seville.
Well, yeah, I mean there was certainly some violent, you know, undertones, obviously reflecting
and
the times
and violence. Yes, lots of violence.
But the Tom and Jerry ones were like a little more over the top, like, you know, they're trying to kill each other with axes and, you know, like I was always sort of, you know, a little more of the extreme version of that. And yeah, of course that's the inspiration for Itchy and Scratchy, but yeah, it's one of those ones when you go back now and you look at it, some of it you're like, there's no world in which I would show this to a child. I must admit, even in the Looney Tunes ones, I'm a humongous Looney Tunes fan, always have been, and I have all the golden collections, the restored versions of all the cartoons. There are some of them in there that I was quite happy to share with my children and watch with them, and there were some where I was like, we're not watching this one because it just does not hold up well. The violence level, the nuance is lost on children. Now you can look at them as sort of time capsules, but you know, not a kid's not going to do that, and we certainly didn't do that. They're a little more over the top than I remember.
Right. Fun times.
Mm-hmm. Yep. My real watch list item is Big Mouth. Season 4 starts tomorrow, so that's how I'm going to spend my weekend.
I'm going to go back and watch season 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah, again, really, really like the easiest show to binge because it's just...
Which
Netflix.
Netflix, okay.
Yeah, I just actually sat down right since you had a little late start tonight. I sat down and just watched the last episode of the previous season just to remind myself where we were at. I remember it all clicked sort of back in pretty quickly to where we left things off. But I love that show. It's so gross and funny and smart. They do
long story arcs too as well?
Each episode sort of stands alone, but they do a lot of character development. The idea is about, like, the whole sort of story is about these sort of pubescent children who are, you know, moving into their, awakenings. And so from the beginning of the series through till the end of season 3, there is a lot of, growth and, what they experience. You know, some of the girls, obviously they, go from being like little girls to having their periods and everything else. The boys, discover sex and sexuality. There's lots of sort of storylines. They date each other. They stop dating each other. A couple of the kids come out, so it does sort of evolve a little bit. One of the kids has a really, weird relationship with his couch cushions that sort of goes on for a few episodes. And it's so crazy and over the top. But oh my God, is that show ever funny? It's so funny. It's especially funny because like one of the stars is John Mulaney, who's, pretty clean comic and that gets a lot of like mainstream stuff. Mm-hmm. But the stuff they have his character Andrew do on the show is filthy and disgusting. Like he spent a good portion of the last episode of season 3 completely naked, full frontally naked in the cartoon. It's very funny.
Mm. I just finished watching The Watchmen.
Oh yeah, how'd you like it?
It's good.
Yeah, it's really good, eh?
Yeah. Like, and I see why you sort of like, hey, where's the next season coming from? Because it does kind of end on a possibilities, right?
It does, but I mean, the creator David Lindelof basically said like that's all I wanted to say, and they don't intend to go back to it. So that's it. But I mean, they won like a pile of Emmy awards for it. And,
is that the one that Regina King won for recently?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
Okay.
And her husband in it. He's starting to sort of get some heat as an actor too. I'm trying to remember his name. But he's quite good, I thought. Yeah. And it's funny because it really is sort of it's sort of structured around a follow-up to The Watchmen, but it really kind of takes on its own thing and sort of becomes its own thing. Again, I didn't want to like it because I don't like the idea of messing with properties like that, but it's
so this good. Is like not canon per se, like it wasn't in the books or whatever?
No, not at all. And so for the longest time, Watchmen was just sort of a standalone story. That was it. It was done in 1986. That was it. And then probably 10 years ago, DC sort of broke the seal and decided to have a whole bunch of other creators start working on in that universe. They wrote a whole bunch of prequel series and sequel series and brought the Watchmen into the DC universe in its own way and really kind of mucked about. And I really had a tough time with that.
Right.
And again, I'm sure they're good.
President, right?
What's that?
The original one had Nixon as president.
Yes, that he had held on to the presidency, a la the person who doesn't know when to leave.
And then Robert Redford, the president, is that the Robert Redford we all know and love and mm-hmm. The Natural, or a different dude?
No, I think it's supposed to be the same dude.
Oh, really? Wow. Cool.
Yeah, but yeah, I thought it was really, really well done, and again, very poignant considering the the political atmosphere in the last year or two. I thought it really, starts with a hell of a bang, and then just sort of keeps it going from there. And just so many good performances. I thought, Regina King is a revelation, but I thought
I've always been a fan of hers, actually.
She's quite good, yeah. But some of the supporting performances, Don Johnson, and oh, what's his name? Louis Gossett. I mean, he's in his 80s now. I mean, he was amazing, I thought. The whole storyline with him and, you know, being undercover as white to fit in. And oh my God, that was so good.
Oh, is that what he was doing? Putting white makeup around his eyes?
Yeah. Yeah. He was pretending to be white so that people wouldn't catch on that it was him because they didn't want him to be out there, right?
Interesting. Yeah. Because I didn't quite catch that. I mean, I wasn't really paying attention, I guess, but I noticed when he was taking the makeup off that there seemed to be a different color around his eyes. And I figured that was what it was, right?
So, yeah.
Really sort of twisty with the whole, was it done around the time of Black Lives Matter? It was before.
So again, really prescient in its sort of, it just became the perfect encapsulation of the time right at the right time.
Yeah, yeah. I love the sort of twist around the Don Johnson character when Regina King says, did I start this?
Yeah. Yeah.
The whole paradox. Yeah, mm-hmm. That was kind of cool. Mm-hmm. That was cool. And Jean Smart was good at it.
Oh, too. You're right. Yeah.
I like the crossover between the characters. Of course, I didn't recognize by the names of, like, I didn't realize that Jeremy Irons' character was the same character, one of the main characters in the first Watchmen, right?
Yeah, he's Ozymandias.
I didn't make the connection until he put the suit on at the very end, right?
And again, he was great too. That whole sort of weird storyline of him and the, you know, where is he and what's he doing and stuff like that. And then it all comes together. Again, it was just, I thought it was really well paced and just, you know, it was like the perfect amount of everything. I didn't feel like it was too long or too short. I didn't feel like I was not enough time with a character or too much time. It really was a masterful piece of television.
I thought it was really, really good. And I think answers a few kind of interesting things here. It's, I don't know if you guys went into spoiler territory, but I ended up thinking, I haven't had time to really sit and think it out. I was like, oh, I thought this was about race for the theme of the season.
I was expecting something completely different too, based on the trailers and stuff, right?
And it's like that for quite some way. And I said, no, actually at the meta level, it's about legacy, which often racial problems and tensions are part, a very uncomfortable part of legacy. So there,
right.
Welcome to my TED Talk analysis of Watchmen.
Well, I was telling Jonathan, I like the sort of paradox that's in the middle of the whole thing, right? Why what's his name gets killed in the beginning?
Don
Johnson. Yeah. And it's interesting because they do bring him back in the sort of flashback too, which is kind of cool, right? But the whole concept of how one of the main characters lives his life, not knowing or sort of living his whole life at once, kind of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is an interesting sort of storyline to think about, right? So, whereas, you know, the rest of the people live a sort of linear lifestyle, right?
Yeah. I don't know. I thought there was some really good twists in there. And again, I think you and I talked about the performances were just across the board exceptional. Well realized, but it was just a murderer's row of really talented people doing really good work.
And now I finally understand when I had asked, oh, does it end on a cliffhanger? It doesn't really end on a cliffhanger. Like the sort of final question you might have is more of an interesting philosophical one, like at the end of Inception, where the main story is done. It's a very satisfying ending. And you just have a final shot that's like, oh, I wonder what happened there. And you can sort of argue.
Well, don't really know like what happens, right? Like it just like as the, you know, the foot comes down. Literally, we don't know what happens, right? Like they cut to black screen, don't they?
Yeah, just like Inception, where you don't know what happens in the final shot, like
right.
You know, half a second after the final shot, what do you think happened?
Yeah.
But again, it's kind of the perfect ending too.
Well, do you think, like, I think you were saying too that you know, they didn't know, the audience didn't know when it was finished, if it was really finished. And you said that we talked about it on the show that the creator said he's done, right? But
yeah.
So is that meant to be like a Sopranos kind of ending where it just ends and you don't know what the actual final resolution is, right?
Yeah, I think it's deliberately ambiguous. I think the idea is you're supposed to, you can use your imagination and it is open if somebody else, so Damon Lindelof is the showrunner on that one and the visionary behind it. He had said, well, you know, I'm done. That's all I had to say. If somebody else wants to pick it up and run with it, maybe they can pick that story up there and go if they want to go somewhere with it. But I'm not, I don't have anything else to say.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Yeah.
But again, saying to Tim earlier, Jaime, it just felt like it was just sort of the perfect amount. I didn't feel like I was wanting more. I didn't feel like I was sort of cheated of anything. I feel like it was paced really well. It just sort of was exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right, kids. Talk to you later.
All right. Have a good weekend, guys.
Have a good one. Bye.